Here's episode 6, Truth About Vaccines, April 2020.
EPA was able to prove that Welcome back to the Truth About Vaccines. This is episode number 6. When you were a child, did you have the chicken pox? Are you aware that scientists have found retroviruses in many of the common vaccines in the CDC schedule today? These two topics and many more will be addressed in tonight's episode. I hope you enjoy it. We've spent thousands of hours filming, scripting, and producing these 7 episodes. And our goal with the Truth About Vaccines is to present this information in as clear, precise, accurate, yet unbiased method as is humanly possible, asking questions and interviewing experts who advocate using the scientific method to discover the truth about vaccines. So let's get rolling with tonight's episode.
In medical school, we were taught something called the scientific method. So I blame my medical school training on what I'm about to say. We were trained to create a question, go through the steps of evaluating the answers to that question, and be willing to look at the data and not eliminate it if we don't like it, and then come to some conclusion about our original question, even if we don't like the conclusion we come to. The scientific method requires us to think and ask a question, even if it's an uncomfortable question. In our current state of affairs, we're not allowed to ask the question. That's not science anymore. That's ideology and dogma.
You saw the same kind of dynamic that we've seen in orthodoxies throughout history, which is a misplaced faith in an undeserving authority, which is the CDC. And then a need to silence any kind of dissent, you know, so the heretics get burned. There's no debate. We have to make sure that nobody even talks about this. Nobody questions the received orthodoxies and the dogma.
We want to question the dogma. We want to discuss the issues. But unfortunately, if there's corruption within an industry or company or government agency, those who question are dismissed and even fired. Have you ever heard the term whistleblower? This is the person that informs on a person or organization that's engaged in an illicit activity. For people who work for the federal government, the Whistleblower Protection Act, or WPA, protects federal employees who disclose illegal or improper government activities. Dr. David Lewis is one such whistleblower.
The fact is that both government and industry are increasingly using false allegations of research misconduct to discredit scientists who raise questions about government policies and industry practices. It's something that I experienced myself when I published research that questioned an EPA policy. Then a large corporation in the business, I was looking at an environmental issue, land application of sewage sludge, accused me of research misconduct. And so that went through a couple of years of litigation before EPA was able to prove that the allegations were false. But oftentimes, even when a scientist is vindicated after such accusations, recovering their career is difficult. So that is an area that for the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C., I have worked for a number of years to investigate numerous cases where that occurs. And vaccine safety is one of those areas where it commonly occurs. As a senior level research microbiologist, I was involved in directing research projects on everything from climate change to pollutants in the environment. And I got the chance to see from the inside how science is funded by the federal government through grants to universities to be published in the scientific literature. And having seen how the system worked, I became concerned about the process that science within the EPA, and I saw the same thing at the CDC, the FDA, other federal agencies, and at the universities that they funded, was all geared towards supporting certain government policies and industry practices. So scientists who published data that supported the government's policies and certain industry practices that were economically important became promoted. They freely published in the scientific literature. Whereas if data were generated in research that raised questions about certain government policies or industry practices, that research would be suppressed. Their research would not be published. So it was a system of using public funds in that manner that led me to keep a lot of records. I ended up filing a number of lawsuits, whistleblower lawsuits, in order to keep being able to do my research, regardless of what the outcome was. And my book, Science for Sale, documents that experience over my career. The issue of vaccine safety is an issue that I firsthand saw, that certain government agencies and certain universities are manipulating the data in order to protect the sales of vaccines and to cover up any adverse effects.
Cover up adverse effects? This goes back to what Dr. Larry Pilevsky said at the beginning of the episode. That's not science, it's dogma. It's working backwards to arrive at a predetermined conclusion. But why would institutions like the CDC, who have been sworn to protect our children's health, be engaged in ideology rather than in science?
So as a pediatrician, you're trained to believe that the CDC is the top. NIH and CDC are the top institutions where all the smartest people are, right? And so we just accepted what they fed us without questioning, right? So that's where I was when I got out of medical school, and that's where I was for the first few years of my practice. That all changed in 2001 when they pushed the Hep B onto newborns because it made no sense. It is scientifically illogical and absolutely insane to inject that much toxin into a baby who doesn't even get any protection from the vaccine. We now have almost 20-year data. Actually, there are some 20-year data studies showing that the hepatitis B isn't even giving lasting immunity. So about 24% of 20-year-olds who got the vaccine as an infant still have immunity. So when they need it most, when they're sexually active as a, you know, late teens, 20s, they don't have the protection. So that was when my blind faith in the CDC just went out the window, and I started going, there's something going on here. And sadly, those who really understand what's going on, this revolving door between CDC and pharma that has been documented, I mean, people who worked at very high levels in the CDC end up working for pharma, they're conflicted. So I think, sadly, when you have conflicts of interest, you know, people like to say, well, there are no conflicts of interest here. But there are, and they've been documented.
Many employees of the CDC end up in industry. You know, case in point, Dr. Julie Gerberding, who was the director of the CDC from 2001 until 2008, took a very lucrative position as the head of the vaccine division in Merck in 2009. She, you know, was given stock options in the millions for that particular position, and so she overnight became a millionaire. There have been other employees that have gone on to lucrative positions. There's actually a revolving door between the CDC and the vaccine industry. Dr. Thompson himself came from Merck. He worked at Merck before he worked at the CDC. Dr. Frank DiStefano, who is the current head of the Immunization Safety Office at the CDC, actually left the CDC, went into industry, and then came back to the CDC. And so, you know, you have this incestuous relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the CDC. So really the driver is money. You know, it's just like everything else. The driver is the almighty dollar. And the when you get a vaccination on the schedule, when an individual, which could be a CDC employee, gets a vaccination on the schedule, that opens up a market for that particular vaccine that's in the billions of dollars.
The CDC has a conflict of interest because they are looking after vaccine safety, but they're also promoting vaccines. So we have to take the ability for the CDC to be responsible for vaccine safety. We have to put that into an independent commission. The CDC cannot be trusted to look after vaccine safety issues because they have a conflict of interest where they are interested in pushing as many vaccines as they possibly can. Okay, so that's a big conflict of interest.
You know, if viewers are not aware of this, people need to see the CDC, at least as it is today, as just a marketing branch of pharma. So their job, and you can even look at their mission statement, it's to promote vaccines, right? And if we could just change their mission to promoting healthy children, right? Let's get healthy people, a healthy society, healthy children, and look at vaccines, are they helping or not? And that's what hasn't been done.
In our democracy, you have a number of institutions that are there to protect little children from predatory corporations, and all of these have been neutralized here. You have the regulatory agency at the front line, protector of public health, that has been captured by the agency to become a sock puppet to the industry that it's supposed to regulate. It's an arm of the pharmaceutical industry. CDC sells $4.6 billion worth of worth of vaccines every year itself.
Wait.
It owns the patent.
CDC sells vaccines?
Yes, CDC sells vaccines. So CDC is regulating an industry that it's part of.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just stated that the CDC sells vaccines and actually holds patents on vaccines. I wanted to verify this, so I did a patent search. Turns out that he's accurate. The CDC actually is listed as an assignee on over 50 patents related to vaccines, including flu, rotavirus, hepatitis A, HIV, anthrax, rabies, pneumococcal, meningococcal, and several other vaccines. Does this seem like a public health agency that's making independent vaccine recommendations? Or does it seem like an agency acting as a risk management group that influences public opinion?
You know, I look at this movement and I don't know why we haven't taken to the streets with torches yet. I mean, you know, this is manslaughter. I mean, and the carnage that has been laid on our society as a whole, not just because of Thimerosal, not just because of the MMR vaccine, but because we're all part of this grand medical experiment that's called the vaccination schedule that is understudied, that is only studied by the CDC in order to quell the masses. You know, CDC is not there to tell the truth. They are a risk management organization, and they are there to basically produce studies that will sway the opinion towards what CDC wants the public to do, and that is to uptake all of the vaccines that they're recommending on the schedule.
One of the things that I found was the advisory committees. So advisory committees at the FDA, advisory committee at CDC, because there's a process to approve drugs, and my focus at this point was the vaccines.
Okay.
And so they go through these advisory committees, first at the FDA for approval, and then at the CDC for recommendation.
Right.
And there's something called FACA, Federal Advisory Committee Act, which, you know, as you would imagine, says that, you know, anybody on these advisory committees can't have undue conflict of interest,
right.
Can't be employed.
Should be independent.
And it turns out it's just not the case. And at the FDA, the committee is VRBPAC, that's an acronym, and there's one person who's considered the consumer rep. And all that means is that they're not employed by one of the major pharmaceutical company specifically.
Really?
Yes, that's all
that
means. They're usually MDs or MD PhDs or nurses with PhDs, or they can be, you know, somebody without an advanced degree, but commonly they are.
Okay.
And then the same thing is true for the ACIP committee, which is the CDC's committee on vaccines for recommendation. And they also, it turns out that the CDC on their website automatically grants a waiver for the conflict of interest for anybody on the ACIP committee because they believe that they need experts on the committee.
So the conflict of interest rules don't apply to them?
They don't apply to them, even though they're specifically for them. They're for federal advisory committees. I mean, if a regulatory agency isn't, then that's what we're talking about, right? It's all about these federal regulatory agencies.
It makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
As we see in many other areas of life, we look at how money is controlling decisions as opposed to maybe what's good for the people.
Unfortunately, I think that's always the case. It manifests itself in many ways. So you go through the history of other types of environmental agents that caused harm. You go back to lead. Well, there was an industry behind lead that resisted the paint industry in the 20s and 30s. Fluoride is another one that really has not yet manifested itself. Asbestos. Yeah, W.R. Grace fought, and the industry fought very aggressively to resist the idea that asbestos causes mesothelioma or other injuries. And you know, tobacco is a primary example.
That's all about that.
Robert Krakow, K-R-A-K-O-W, Esquire.
You know, Friends Ryan and The Godfather, after all, we are not communists. And so industry is fine. It's fine for people to make money. I have no problem with that. When they cross the line is when it's known, or at least strongly suspected, that injury is occurring. And because of those vested interests, we cannot even explore it. And when you speak about vaccines, that's taboo. You can't hear it. You'll be shut down. Your research funding will be eliminated. If you come on as an expert more than a few times, they'll start criticizing you, so they undermine your ability to be an expert witness.
1645. The second part of episode 6, vaccines. Starting 16 minutes, 47 seconds.
Parents who speak about it, or newspaper articles, they get shut down. Columbia School of Journalism had an article showing how this occurred, and then they retracted it, saying there was no truth to the idea that vaccine causes injury. We know vaccine causes injury. The government acknowledges it. It's their policy. The issue is how often it occurs and how it manifests itself.
Conflicts of interest apparently fueled by greed are rampant at the CDC and other agencies. This is called regulatory capture, and it happens when special interests co-opt policymakers or political bodies, regulatory agencies in particular, to further their own ends. It's very commonplace, as we will see.
There's a dynamic that is well described and well documented and that I encounter virtually every day of my professional life, which is called captive agency phenomena. And that is the process by which agencies become captured by their own orthodoxies or by the industries that they're supposed to regulate. So they become sock puppets for the industry that they're supposed to regulate. And a lot of times they become even more radical in protecting those interests than the industry itself.
The EPA does consider aluminum a toxin.
Okay,
and there
right.
are limits according to the EPA. You know, this is where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, right? So the EPA has all these limits on aluminum, on mercury, and of course those limits are exceeded just within the first vaccine given on the day one of life, the hepatitis B shot. So, you know, we've got a lot of conflict. You know, FDA is saying, the NIH is saying it's gross, the EPA is saying there's toxic levels, and we've got toxic levels exceeding a daily dose in a newborn in a shot.
Way over.
I mean, many times over, right? But this is, I'm just trying to point out the absurdity of all of it.
It is.
You know, it's just, so it's, I realized that the right hand, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, and it's, whether it's intentional or not, I think that there's a lot of scientists and a lot of doctors who believe what they're doing. Yeah. They believe they're working for the good. The doctors believe what the CDC tells them. They believe what the NIH says. There's doctors at the NIH who are doing really good work, and probably there's a lot of really ethical doctors at the NIH, and probably some at the FDA and at the CDC. But overall, they have been captured by the regulatory agencies.
There was Dr. Gary Goldman, who was doing research for the CDC, Center for Disease Control, working on gathering information on the effects of an anti-chickenpox vaccine that they were giving to little kids. And he came up with very serious evidence that the vaccine, although it did seem to reduce the incidence of chickenpox in the children, was actually producing another more serious condition that would occur later on. He found statistical evidence that could not be denied that little children that received the chickenpox vaccine, when they reached maturity, especially when they got past the age of 40, they were more susceptible to shingles, which is a viral infection. It's much more serious than chickenpox.
One of the papers that Dr. Gary Goldman and I co-authored, and by the way, Gary Goldman worked for the CDC. When he worked for the CDC, he found that the chickenpox vaccine was causing increases of shingles, significant increases of shingles. And he tried to get that published, and the CDC blocked him from publishing that information. They allowed him to publish anything that was
Neil Miller,
the chickenpox vaccine, in a good light. But when he found that there was a problem with that vaccine, that it was responsible for causing increases of shingles, which is associated with chickenpox, they blocked him. And they said, this is our data. You can't do that. He said, it's my data. And they went into a court battle, and he won that battle and was eventually able to publish that information. Dr. Gary Goldman is an expert on the varicella virus, which is the virus that causes chickenpox. And that's why they utilized him for 7.5 years to keep databases and to document various changes in society when they introduced the chickenpox vaccine.
I don't understand why the CDC wouldn't allow Dr. Goldman, who worked for the CDC at the time, to publish a study that indicated the chickenpox vaccine causes shingles, which is much more dangerous than chickenpox. But Dr. Goldman's research wasn't the only research that indicates that the chickenpox vaccine causes shingles. Research published in 2011 in the Journal of Infectious Diseases confirms this link. The research team was composed of members from NASA's Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center, University of Texas Health Science Center, University of Colorado Medical School, and the CDC. Let's learn more about the chickenpox vaccine from board-certified pediatrician Dr. Paul Thomas, who offers this vaccine in his practice in Portland, Oregon.
For children, it's varicella vaccine, Varivax. It's recommended age 1 by the CDC. So I had chickenpox. I'm guessing you did too as a kid. My kids all had chickenpox. It used to be one of those rites of passage, right? It's not fun. It's itchy. You miss school for a week. Most kids love that. Deaths from chickenpox obviously is always the big scare, right? And historically and traditionally, there were about 100 deaths a year in the U.S. Almost always, it would be somebody who is immunocompromised, so they were already at risk for death from some infection. But any death is not a good thing, right? So we would like to prevent those deaths. So in comes the varicella vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine, and in my practice, ever since it was introduced, I've always had a number of families that didn't want to do it. They just felt like they wanted their kids to have natural immunity. The vaccine actually works fairly well. So I just had a case of chickenpox yesterday in my practice. It's rare. I mean, I think I could count on one hand the cases I see in a year. We used to see it every week, almost every day. We'd meet them in the parking lot so they didn't come into the office and contaminate everybody. It's very airborne, it's very contagious, and it's just not around anymore. But guess what is around now? Zoster, herpes zoster, which is actually a reactivation of chickenpox. And you can get zoster whether you're vaccinated or whether you had natural chickenpox. And what we're now seeing is the elderly, but we're even seeing zoster in kids. That never happened before. But we're seeing the elderly are having debilitating zoster and sometimes death from chickenpox reactivation. And that is now a new epidemic. And I've read, I don't remember the exact numbers, but we are losing more adults to chickenpox than we ever lost anybody to chickenpox prior to vaccines. So what's happened? I'm pretty sure what's happened is because the chickenpox vaccine works fairly well, kids aren't getting chickenpox anymore. Those kids who got chickenpox were actually the people who kept our immunity boosted through the years. So my kids had chickenpox, they boosted my immunity. Well, now the kids aren't having chickenpox anymore, nobody's getting boosted. And so now that you're having this rise in zoster cases and
now, is that shingles?
Shingles, yeah. So we've made a trade from kids who got chickenpox and could handle it to now the elderly and older people getting reactivated chickenpox, zoster, and shingles. And sometimes it's more debilitating, if not deadly at times. I don't think it's necessarily a good trade-off. I think we might actually be wise to just go back to letting kids get chickenpox. But it's so controversial.
This topic is very controversial today. But when I was a kid, I remember the chickenpox parties that people had. Dr. Thomas mentioned that today the chickenpox vaccine is so controversial. It definitely contains some ingredients that evoke controversy. As we heard earlier in another episode from Dr. Irvin Sawney, vaccines have to be grown in a substrate, which simply means that it takes living tissue to grow the microscopic vaccine ingredients. Animal and even human tissues are used as a culture medium to grow the targeted viruses or bacteria used in vaccines. Today, vaccine viruses are cultured in chicken fibroblast cells and embryos, chick retinal and kidney cells, monkey and dog kidney cells, aborted human fetal lung fibroblast cells, and mouse brain tissue, to name a few. According to the CDC's vaccine excipient table, the ViriVax vaccine contains WI38 and MRC5 cells, both of which were developed from aborted fetal tissue. But the chickenpox vaccine isn't the only one that contains aborted fetal tissue or human DNA.
Many vaccines in the schedule today take human aborted fetal cells, diploid cells they're called, sort of to cover up the fact that they were harvested from, intentionally aborted fetuses to be produced as antigen for vaccines that are being injected, mind you, into those that it completely violates their religious beliefs. If you're a Christian, for example, I think that it's pretty clear you don't want to support abortion, and nor do you want to inject the byproduct of an aborted fetal cell into your own child to confer a health benefit to them.
The subject of aborted fetal tissue in vaccines is definitely something to be aware of. Now, regarding the CDC, I don't want to give the impression that the entire agency is corrupt.
And it's not the whole agency, by the way. It's a small number of people who have become corrupted. And mainly those people are in one office, which is the Immunization Safety Office. That's the office that is charged with reviewing and conducting vaccine safety science. And there are specific members of that group that have corrupted that group. There are two groups within CDC that are relevant to vaccine regulation that have been corrupted and that we should be concerned about. The first of those is the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. And that is the group that decides which new vaccines can be added to the schedule. So the recommended schedule that essentially becomes mandatory when it gets to the state level.
RFK Jr. mentioned that the Immunization Safety Office at the CDC has been compromised. One whistleblower that came forward from that office was Dr. William Thompson, one of the top CDC scientists. Dr. Andrew Wakefield directed a documentary called Vaxxed, and that dealt with the story of Dr. Thompson's discovery of corruption at the CDC and his subsequent whistleblower activities. Here's a brief summary of that amazing story as told primarily by Dr. Wakefield and Dr. Brian Hooker, both of whom were intimately involved.
William Thompson is the first insider in the history of the
Wakefield
come forward from the Immunization Safety Office of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and say, we have known for 13 years that there's a causal association between the MMR vaccine used in America and autism in children, and we have covered it up. We have lied. We have committed scientific fraud, in effect. And they have recklessly and knowingly put millions of children in harm's way to protect what? Their friends in industry, the public confidence in them? How is that going to look when this all comes out, as it will? And Thompson lived with this for 13 years. He actually, at the time, questioned the decision to cover this up. He questioned the decision to destroy documents. He questioned the decision to hide from the Institute of Medicine and Congress the fact that they had found this uncomfortable association between vaccines and autism. But he was silenced, and he went along with it. But his conscience got the better of him, and 13 years later, he came forward to a friend and colleague, Dr. Brian Hooker, father of an autistic child, vaccine-damaged child, and said, we have known for 13 years that these vaccines, this vaccine is causing autism.
They were cooking the books, and when they saw a particular effect that they didn't want, then they would get a bunch of scientists in.
Brian Hooker.
They would look at how they could exclude cases of autism, how they could exclude cases of other disorders that they were studying until they could actually dilute down that effect to the point where it was no longer statistically significant. In 2001, the CDC embarked upon what's called the DiStefano study, and that was a study that they were going to use to absolve the MMR vaccine from the autism epidemic. They basically took a small study sample in metropolitan Atlanta. It had a higher proportion of African-American individuals because that's the demographic in metropolitan Atlanta. And what they found when they originally ran the study was that African-Americans that got the MMR on time were about 2.5 times more likely to get an autism diagnosis versus African Americans that received the MMR after 3 years of age. So they delayed the MMR. And so they tried to bury this effect using statistics. They could not make it go away. So the only recourse that they had was then in 2002, they brought in large trash cans and they just threw out all the information that showed that there was any type of association between MMR and autism, especially in African American populations. Thompson was one of the co-authors on this study, and he secretly kept all of his documents. When he was ordered to throw them all away by his superiors, he kept electronic records on his computer. And just, so, yes.
Sorry to cut you off, but just that statement, they were ordered by their superiors at the CDC to throw away, to get rid of records that showed a result that they didn't want. They had documents that proved that the African-American male babies were at risk, and they got rid of them.
They got rid of that evidence. I mean, that's data fraud.
That's a crime.
In the first degree. I mean, and it's a crime at many levels. I mean, not only looking at, you know, the issue of the Federal Records Act in the federal government. It was enacted in 1950 and it has been amended. But in anything that looks, smells, tastes like a federal record, which undoubtedly these documents were, should have been retained on file and then ultimately should end up in the National Archives. And so they were handled completely incorrectly. On top of that, the results themselves were so alarming, and the CDC knew about this effect as early as 2001. November 7th, 2001 was when Thompson originally presented those results to the rest of the research team.
Wow, I thought it was 2004, it's 2001.
It's 2001. Now,
3 more years.
They knew about it, they massaged the data, they threw everything out, but Thompson in 2004 was conscience stricken, and he was also set to do a presentation at the Institute of Medicine. Institute of Medicine is the quote-unquote independent body that periodically reviews vaccine safety for the CDC. He was set to present these results at the Institute of Medicine, and he was conscience-stricken. He wanted to tell the truth at that Institute of Medicine meeting, that there was a tie, definite tie, between the MMR vaccine and autism, specifically in African-American males. And so he tried to warn, stepped over several levels of management, and he tried to warn Julie Gerberding directly. He sent her a long email saying that there were problematic results that needed to be discussed, that would not bear favorably on the CDC and on the current vaccination schedule.
What was her response?
Her response, she never reached out to Thompson directly. But he was very soon after that put on administrative leave of absence. He received a letter of discipline in his file for insubordination because he didn't go to his direct supervisor, who was the one that ordered him to throw away those documents. And then he was replaced. He was not able to speak at the Institute of Medicine meeting, and instead his direct supervisor, Frank DiStefano, who was responsible for the data destruction, presented something that was totally fraudulent. By my estimates, if you look at the number of African American males that have been born in the United States since 2001, since they known, there have been over 100,000 African American males in the United States that have been diagnosed with autism since that point in time. And you have to wonder, if they would have changed the vaccine schedule, how many individuals would have been spared that lifetime of having that diagnosis, of having those issues, of having, you know, the communication issues, of needing 24-hour care. How many families were destroyed because the CDC made the decision to bury that information? After I was out of contact with the CDC in 2004 and my only recourse was the Freedom of Information Act, nothing prevented me from emailing these characters and pointing out the flaws in their studies. So every now and then, knowing full well I wouldn't get a response, I would email somebody. I would email Frank DiStefano. I would email Robert Chin. I would email Bill Thompson. I would email David Shea. And all this time, I trolled for whistleblowers. Once a year, twice a year, I would send out an email saying, hey, if you ever want to talk, if you ever want to come clean about this, here's my cell phone, here's my private email, we can talk in private. And then something happened in 2013 that really upset me and my family. In 2013, Representative Bill Posey did a congressional request and got about 10,000 pages of CDC documents. And I went through these 10,000 pages at his bequest, and I found where CDC employees, including Bill Thompson, including CDC attorneys, were talking specifically about my son's case in vaccine court. And I was mad. I was, you know, it's like, this is my personal, private business. You have no right to talk about my son standing in vaccine court and about his particular medical condition and how that bears on how you can get me to stop talking to the CDC. And so all these documents came up, and they finally came up in 2013. So I was mad, and I sent some scathing emails directly to Dr. Thompson and said, you know, look, you had no right. You know, these are children. This is my child. And you're treating him like he's some type of statistic that gets you in the way of mind control for the rest of the United States. And so something clicked. And within, you know, maybe 3 months of receiving these emails, I get a call. And it's Dr. Thompson. And he's calling on his private cell phone to my private cell phone. And so when he started to reveal this information to me, he said, I'm going to start emailing you documents that show not only how you can get data from the CDC, so you can independently do an analysis for all of these different studies that he was saying were faulty, and it's in some cases out and out fraudulent. And so he helped me get the data, and when I saw, first of all, the African American effect on the MMR vaccine, and he said, oh, you found it. And then this story started to unfold. He started to tell me that he saw the effect as early as November of 2001. He went with to his superiors. His superiors directly told him that he had to find a way to bury that effect so it would not be reported in that particular paper. And so he went through all of that fraud. He also went through fraud that CDC committed regarding thimerosal-containing vaccines, not only with autism, but with other disorders like tics, speech delay, language delay, IQ, and where CDC specifically would either out-and-out hide the effect by not reporting it, or they would minimize the effect and dismiss it as being not statistically valid.
So this was probably cathartic to him.
Absolutely.
To be able to help you obtain these documents, you know, maybe a weight lifted off of his chest.
Yeah, he said that when my paper was published, I did a reanalysis, and I basically used the CDC's methods in my paper and did a reanalysis and showed the data that was thrown in the trash can. And he said that that was the most relieved that he had felt in, you know, 15 years. So it was truly, you know, a big catharsis for him. He felt like he was getting the truth out. And then rightfully, he knew there would come a point in time where I couldn't just keep it under wraps, that there would be a time where we would need to blow this story open and out him as a whistleblower.
In 2004, the main journal that pediatricians read, it's just called Pediatrics, came out with a study. DiStefano, I think, was one of the lead authors, saying that there was no link between MMR and autism, because they had been charged, I guess the CDC had been asked by Congress to look into this. So, you know, from then on, that next year, within that next year, the Institute of Medicine, the IOM, came out with a huge report. It's been proven there's no link between vaccines and autism, no link between vaccines and thimerosal, and they made this strange statement, and we shouldn't study it any further. And I remember reading that going, that makes no sense, because we were in the midst of a crisis in our country with regards to children's health.
In every city, I have recordings of names of black mothers, of Latino mothers, of Native American mothers, and poor white mothers, because that's a group that no one is talking about. The middle class is particularly aware, but the poor have no idea. In fact, in every city that I've gone to, when I asked the black community, how many of you know what autism is? No one raised their hand on me. They have no idea. I was invited to inner city schools by black educators. They said, come in my classroom, look at the black boys. And when you look at them, 70 to 80% of them, they look spacey. They're tapping on the desk. They're not doing anything. You can't get them to interact. I'm saying, my gosh, something is fundamentally wrong.
They knew at the CDC that vaccines increase the risk of autism in young African American boys, specifically boys. And if you look at the rates of autism in the African American community, guess what? It's predominantly boys. There is a genetic and biochemical reason for that. The CDC was aware of that. They chose to cover it up. They committed scientific fraud. They altered the data to eliminate the statistical certainty of that conclusion. And they knew that over a decade ago. So for the last, really, 15 plus years, black children in America have been medically harmed, tortured, desecrated by a medical system that knew that those children would have their lives destroyed. A medical system that said nothing. Just like the children in Flint, Michigan, who were poisoned by lead in the water, and that's been called a crime against humanity. The EPA knew about that lead, and the Michigan governor knew about that lead. They did nothing. The crime against children happening in vaccines is 1,000 times larger. It's not just Flint, Michigan. It's every city in America. Every population of young black children or African American families raising kids. Every population where those kids are getting vaccinated is currently being devastated by these toxic effects of the vaccine, and an industry that knows it is essentially committing what we have to call medical genocide against black children.
It's unconscionable, and there has to be an awakening in the African American community. We have got to reach out to our churches, to our legislators, and have a voice in this. Black boys.
Allison Fulmer, F-O-L-M-A-R, civil rights attorney.
Well, no, I'm sorry. 296% more likely to become autistic than those children of other races directly as a direct link to the MMR vaccine.
The CDC knew that the MMR was causing autism in black baby boys, and they did nothing for over a decade. I want to read a statement released by Dr. William Thompson on August 27th, 2014. He said, "I regret that my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article published in the journal Pediatrics. The omitted data suggested that African-American males who received the MMR vaccine before age 36 months were at increased risk for autism. Was this a criminal act?"
It's criminal on many levels. You know, first of all, you've got the actual cheating, the fraud, the deception of people in the first place, so that parents can't get informed consent about the safety of a vaccine because they're being told a lie, because the pediatricians are being told a lie by the CDC. So there is a lack of informed consent to parents. They are unknowingly, unwittingly putting their children at high risk without knowing anything about it. Number two is that what happens when the CDC presented their data to the Institute of Medicine, then Frank DiStefano got up there and lied about the data. The message to the Institute of Medicine, the IOM, was that MMR vaccine is safe. The IOM produced a report which said, this vaccine is safe. There is no need for any further research to be funded on the possibility that MMR vaccine is causing autism. That went to the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, a vaccine court.
And Dr. Andrew Wakefield,
who had claims in that court, were denied. Their cases were thrown out in large part based upon the fraud committed by the CDC. And that is an obstruction of justice. Now you're talking about a felony. Now you're talking about a crime that will send these people to prison. Then you have lying to Congress. They have lied to Congress. They've lied by omission, by Colleen Boyle going to Congress, knowing these results at the CDC, being a co-author on that paper, and saying MMR vaccine is safe, continue as we are. So you have crime on multiple levels. Yeah. That then should have been, it's the biggest medical fraud in the history of the world. It should have made national news on every network, in every print newspaper. None of them touched it. Why? Because they're owned by the pharmaceutical industry. They're owned, and their script is written by the pharmaceutical industry. And that is the problem.
Are you enjoying episode 6 thus far? Have you learned some valuable information? Do you want to join our movement and support our mission to educate the world on the truth about vaccines? Then please consider supporting our mission by owning the complete series today. Your support allows us to continue to spread the truth for free. Also, a portion of each sale goes to charities that are doing real research to help our children be healthier and safer. Simply click the banners below to join our movement and support our mission. Thanks in advance. Now, let's get back to episode number 6 for more valuable information on vaccines.
I got into it because I was working on the daytime talks for the doctors as a producer. I spent 6 years celebrating the best medicine has to offer, cutting-edge techniques, less invasive surgeries. You know, I was always into how do we do this better, you know what I mean, better medicine, better health. And then, of course, I was sort of one of the more radical producers on the show in that I always went to stories where I thought corporations were getting involved or, you know, were overly involved in getting in the way of health. So, you know, I did a story about Monsanto when the WHO ruled that glyphosate was probably carcinogenic to humans, the herbicide that's on 90% of our crops. I was able to get a debate on our show between one of the heads of toxicology at Monsanto and Jeffrey Smith, the GMO activist. So I was able to pull things off like that. So I've always sort of been challenging, you know, the status quo, I guess, and sort of the corporate takeover of things that affect our health. So when I got involved and ran into Andy and the story came about, and I saw the data and I saw the proof, I saw when we have a whistleblower from our most important health agency, Dr. William Thompson, when I saw what he was saying in 4 hours of recorded interviews, and then not just making these statements, but backing it up with, you know, 10,000 documents, including internal emails and, you know, data charts, I just sat there staring at it thinking, oh my God, this is the biggest story of my lifetime. This is the greatest medical fraud in the history of the world. One of our top scientists at the most important scientific health agency in the world, the CDC, the leader of all health in the world, this scientist has come forward and given us proof that they've committed fraud. They've hidden the fact that one of these vaccines causes and can cause, you know, be causally related to autism. I mean, that's a shocking discovery. And so if they're lying about that, what else are they lying about?
What you're dealing with here are people who have sworn to protect the health of the children of this country. It's not just that they're neutral on this, they have actually undertaken, as part of their professional and moral obligation, part of the CDC to be responsible for the protection of the health of the children of this country, and quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. They are deliberately, knowingly, and recklessly putting them at risk of a major, lifelong, debilitating disease.
The specific case that I spent most of my time getting to the bottom of,
David Lewis,
Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and the research that he published in Lancet, in which the studies documented the fact that a number of parents linked their children's autism to the MMR vaccine. So I investigated the original data involved in that case that were published in the Lancet. What caught my attention was the massive news media coverage of fraud, supposedly, on the part of Dr. Andrew Wakefield in that study. I was able to go back and obtain a lot of the original documents in those experiments that the British Medical Journal claimed did not exist. When I reviewed those documents, I found that it was clear that Dr. Wakefield had not committed any research fraud. And so I presented the results of my investigation on a panel discussion at Harvard University in 2011, showing that the evidence disputed the claims of research fraud against Dr. Wakefield.
Dr. Wakefield's research has been reproduced by at least 28 other studies. Let me ask you a question. In the first episode, we analyzed whether or not we're being given informed consent when it comes to vaccines. If we are not being given informed consent, then by definition, forced vaccines are in direct violation of the Nuremberg Code set up after World War II to provide guidelines for medical experimentation in the future.
Look at Nigeria. Pfizer used children for their vaccine experiments. It was so heinous and so criminal that the government of Nigeria handed down criminal indictments against the CEOs of Pfizer, called for their arrest. Look at the history of United States medical experimentation on African Americans and prisoners, and the NIH even funded medical experiments against people in Guatemala. The system of government and pharmaceutical interests has for generations exploited humans for medical experiments in order to maintain profit and power and control over the population.
The CDC and World Health Organization went overseas and they had an experimental measles vaccine, and they experimented on black babies overseas in third world nations, and they found out that their experimental vaccine was a killer. It was killing babies at statistically significantly higher rates than if you didn't vaccinate those children at all. And then once they found out it was a killer disease,
Neil Miller
said, you know what, let's check it out and see if it does the same thing to American black babies. Let's go into the inner cities of LA, Los Angeles, and let's pick out the cities, the counties that have the highest black populations, and let's give them our experimental measles vaccine so that we can determine if it's just babies in Africa or if it has the same effect on babies here in the United States. And they did that until they got caught.
Now, I could cry for all the children that I've seen damaged in the 35 years I've been doing this work, catastrophically damaged. children who will never be able to function in any meaningful way, families absolutely destroyed by the impact of vaccines on their children. And meanwhile, we have a medical profession and governments who are not only ignoring the crisis, but they are...
Etta West, founder of Vaccine Choice Canada.
On the corruption and the fraud that has existed in the science that has allowed this to continue on and on.
For me, this is very personal. There are documents that showed that Merck, and that who has ties into the CDC, knew as early as 1991 that there was a problem with the expanding vaccination schedule. The vaccination schedule started to expand in the early 1990s, and the amount of thimerosal that these kids were getting. Merck knew about that. They could have done something about that, and they could have studied it aggressively and truthfully back in 1991, way before my son was ever exposed to any of those vaccines. So it really does hit home.
This is a very personal issue for many families across the globe. According to Dr. Hooker, Merck knew in 1991, but they did nothing. Why? The Vaccine Act that was passed in the late 1980s that exempted vaccine manufacturers from legal liability gave rise to an almost exponential growth in the number of vaccines that were mandated by the CDC schedule because there was no longer any accountability.
Act suddenly provoked a gold rush in the vaccine industry. When I was a kid, there were, you know, I don't even think the polio vaccine was patented. Vaccine, nobody was making money on vaccines when I was a boy. They were essentially a civic duty by the vaccine companies, by the pharmaceutical industries. But suddenly, the industry realized now we have a product that the federal government is going to order 100 million or even 200 million people to buy. The profit margins are huge. You know, some of these vaccines cost $300 per shot. There's no advertising cost, there's no marketing cost, and there's no liability. And also the process for approving those vaccines are streamlined. They don't have to do the standard double-blind placebo studies that the rest of the pharmaceutical industry has to do to bring its product to market. It's a streamlined process that has very, very little in the way of safety scrutiny. So compared to other drugs. So there was a rush, a gold rush, to put new vaccines onto the schedule. And the group within the CDC that made the decision about which vaccines to add, you know, in a perfect world, that would have been a group of kind of geeky scientists who were completely preoccupied with public health outcomes, and that's what it used to be. By 1989, CDC structure had changed, and the people who sit on that committee, the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices, many of them are not even CDC employees. And almost all of them have some financial ties or conflicts of interest to the industry. And I'll give you an example. In 1989, CDC put Dr. Paul Offit, who was one of the great promoters of unlimited vaccines, and he is a vaccine industry insider. He holds a chair at Merck at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that is financed by Merck. And he sat on the advisory committee when the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices voted to add the rotavirus vaccine to the schedule. Paul Offit owned a patent to a rotavirus vaccine, and yet he did not recuse himself. He voted to add it. And as a result of that, of having the rotavirus vaccine part of that mandatory schedule, Offit was able to sell his product a couple of years later for $182
million. $182
million? Yeah. And we don't know exactly how much of that Offit personally pocketed, but it's estimated generally around $29 million. Oh, he's become a multimillionaire through conflicts of interest. The politics. politicians have been paid off. The pharmaceutical company puts more into lobbying, more money that pharmaceutical industries than any other industry. You would think oil and gas, that's number two. And pharma puts double what oil and gas puts in. Four times what military and aerospace puts in. There's more pharmaceutical lobbyists in Washington, D.C. than there are congressmen.
I do admire Dr. Jonas Salk for his willingness to test the polio vaccine not only on himself, but on his own family. Oh. It certainly appears that the monetary factor was not a primary motivation back in the 1950s, but rather the desire to prevent diseases like polio. However, things have most definitely changed in today's heavily lobbied pharmaceutical vaccine landscape. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. mentioned that Paul Offit has made an estimated $29 million on his Rotatec vaccine.
I truly believe that Paul Offit is someone who cares about children and wants what's in the best interest of our children's health. I know that that's not a popular opinion among people who point out that he has gained a lot financially from being one of the inventors of the vaccine against rotavirus. But, you know, a backstory about that is that, you know, when he was in training, he was in Appalachia and he saw a child die. And that child technically died of rotavirus. And so what Paul Offit said was, what can we do to fix this? I mean, Paul Offit did not create the rotavirus vaccine to hurt children. Paul Offit thinks that vaccines are a miracle of modern medicine. And the problem is that the rotavirus vaccine is very problematic. First of all, rotavirus is a disease that almost every child in America under 5 gets. And it's a pretty benign disease. It can put you in the emergency room. You can end up getting severely dehydrated, but you know, we have excellent techniques to rehydrate kids. It is not a vaccine that a child in America needs. That's different if you go overseas and if you're talking about kids who are malnourished or kids who have no access to medical care. Rotavirus might be an appropriate vaccine. It's not an appropriate vaccine for American kids.
The first one that came on the market was clearly causing intussusception, intestinal obstruction, and got pulled. All right, and there's world data that vaccine is still doing that. All right, so it's a vaccine that has some real risks. And for me, the benefits are negligible, if any. So I've been practicing pediatrics for 30 years, and I have had maybe 2 or 3 kids end up in the hospital for IV fluids from severe vomiting and diarrhea that was caused by rotavirus. That's the worst case scenario. If you live in a country, or if you live in a city, or if you live in a place where you can get to a hospital and get IV fluids, that's probably 1 in 10,000. I'm just throwing out a guess number just based on my experience. But it's a very rare likelihood that you're going to need IV fluids. And I've actually looked at my own data, because since I don't do rotavirus, I thought I should look at the data and see, are my kids sicker? Are they having more vomiting or diarrhea? Are they ending up in the hospital more often? And you might be surprised to find out the rotavirus patients, so they would join my practice, they'd already gotten that vaccine, had more diarrhea, more vomiting, more ER visits, way more office visits. For what? Vomiting, diarrhea, gastroenteritis. So the data doesn't support using that vaccine at all, period. There's one other fact that people may not know about that vaccine. If you don't start that vaccine by 9 months of age, you can't give it at all. You have to give it to little tiny babies.
The rotavirus.
Yeah. Okay. If you're 1 year old or 2 year old or you or I, we can't take that vaccine. You might say, well, why? Well, it makes us sick. It clearly makes us worse. It's dangerous for us. But somehow, it's okay to give it to a 2-month-old with a very immature immune system. You're putting a live virus that's contaminated. These vaccines are not pure. They're contaminated with other viruses. Both the vaccines that are on the market have been proven to be contaminated. It makes no sense.
In 2010,
Barbara Lou Fisher, National Vaccine Information Center,
that there was porcine circovirus, that's a pig virus, PCV1 in GlaxoSmithKline's rotavirus vaccine that is a live virus vaccine given to young infants to prevent diarrhea. They also found PCV2, which is another porcine pig virus, that is actually lethal to infant pigs. It causes a wasting disease. They found DNA. This was DNA from these two pig viruses they found in the rotavirus vaccines.
These are very problematic, if not potentially cancerous viruses. In fact, Judy Mikovits, who's on our advisory board, wrote a book called The Plague, and it's all about what has been known for quite some time. It's an amazing book. It is so important that if you haven't heard it, that's probably why, because they are doing everything in their power to suppress this woman's work. They literally put her in jail for her advocacy and her discovery because they were so scared of the implications. It means that
Sayer G.
biologicals category of pharmaceuticals, which includes vaccines and blood products and monoclonal antibodies, may be infected with viruses that literally cause cancer and all types of neurological issues. And there's no way you can recall them because they're in the actual vaccine production process themselves.
I actually believe that it's a pretty effective vaccine. It's really worked to take rotavirus out of circulation, but what has been the effect of that? Well, one of the effects has been that we now have another virus called norovirus that is much more virulent than rotavirus. So last year there were schools that were closed down because so many kids got norovirus and they had violent diarrhea, violent vomiting. They were literally
Jennifer Margulis.
They had to close several schools. And the theory that I have behind that is that since rotavirus, which was relatively benign, that almost every child in America got before age 5 and recovered from, no child in America has ever died from rotavirus except that, with the exception of that kid that poor Paul Offit saw when he was a young doctor, you know. Kids in America don't die of rotavirus. There's no reason to be giving the rotavirus vaccine. Now that we have it and now that it was so effective, we've created a situation where norovirus can become virulent, and now we're seeing even more problems. So we had a vaccine that we thought could solve problems, and it's actually creating more problems than it solved. There is no question that rotavirus is one vaccine that should no longer be on the schedule. I think he's wrong in his fanaticism of defending vaccines. It's like Paul Offit has stopped thinking. It's like he's just defending. And if Paul Offit could just take a deep breath and take a look at the science that he loves to cite, he would realize that some of what he's recommending is actually wrong. It's very hard to admit that you've been wrong.
In 2008, the Inspector General of HHS did an investigation of that scandal. They concluded that up to 97% of the people who sit on those committees could have the same kind of conflicts as often.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. quoted a study that indicated 97% of the people that sit on these regulatory committees have conflicts of interest. How can they be independent? Sayer G. mentioned retroviruses being found in the rotavirus vaccines. He also mentioned Judy Mikovits, a scientist who worked for the National Cancer Institute for almost 3 decades, and who began to find XMRV, xenotropic murine-related virus, in vaccines.
You were with, for 30 years with the National Cancer Institute, is that
well,
correct?
20-some, yeah.
20-something years.
But 33 years as a collaborator with Frank Rossetti, who was at the National Cancer Institute for more than 40 years.
What does XMRV stand for?
XMRV stands for xenotropic murine leukemia virus related virus. So what this virus was described by Joe DeRisi and Bob Silverman by a technology that found sequences of this virus in prostate cancer patients.
Judy Mikovits.
You can find it in people without an inability in their immune system to break down these viruses. And so what they found was in prostate cancer patients, this mouse-related leukemia virus, it causes leukemia in mice. And they found it in prostate cancer patients. And they hypothesized that, in fact, if you have an inability in your immune system to degrade certain viruses, then they're going to contribute to the most aggressive forms of prostate cancer.
And you're talking about a virus that's from a mouse?
Yeah. And so the question is, how did it get in the human population? Well, a paper that was published in 2011, an opinion paper by a guy named Bob Burkow, who worked a lot in HIV/AIDS when I was in HIV/AIDS in the 80s and 90s. He wrote a paper that said the most likely place that these mouse-related viruses were introduced into the human population were vaccines. And because we grow all our vaccines and all our biological drugs, think about all of the mAbs, you know, rituximab, all of the therapies that we've used in the last 20 years are all monoclonal antibodies, and those are all mouse-derived therapeutics. And so what we learned was, in fact, the mouse-derived viruses were coming right along and carried into the therapeutics, and we didn't recognize that pieces and parts and actually fully functional viruses were contaminating our vaccines, including MMR.
What's equally as bad as those ingredients to me are the stray viruses in the viral contaminants that come off of the animal cells that the vaccines are grown in. Those retroviruses could be incorporated into the DNA of children and adults that we don't even know what the outcome could be, because you can't track a retrovirus that has been woven into the intracellular DNA.
There is reverse transcriptase activity in MMR vaccines recognized since 1994.
Well, what do you mean by reverse transcriptase?
Reverse transcriptase is an enzyme that only retroviruses have. And so what it does is it reverse transcribes, writes backwards, are the genome, which is RNA, into DNA, and then it inserts itself into your DNA and stays there for your lifetime and for generations after that. So reverse transcriptase is a hallmark of the presence of a retrovirus. So in 1994, our government, the UK government, the WHO, the World Health Organization, everybody accepted and talked about and discussed in institution of medicine meetings the presence of reverse transcriptase in the MMR vaccine and whether or not it posed a threat. Well, fast forward to 2011, our work and the ramifications of our work said, absolutely, it makes a difference. And absolutely, it makes a difference. Absolutely, it's there. And oh my God, it was the big oh my God moment in our book, In Plague, where we presented these data. And they basically said, we can't stop this. They're everywhere. They're in our lab workers, they're in our doctors, they're in our nurses. We introduced, unwittingly and unknowingly, into the human population a new family of retroviruses that has long been associated with cancers, leukemia, lymphoma, neuroimmune disease, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and such. And so we're looking at the very explosion of these diseases in our world today. And when the government realized how big it was, will we tell the truth? Will we say we introduced it by a contaminated blood supply or contaminated vaccines? No, we won't. We'll just make sure Judy Mikovits and Frank Rossetti go away forever and that nobody ever believes a word they said and that this work is all fraud. But the one little problem they had was I wouldn't sign that piece of paper. I wouldn't agree. I wouldn't say it. The data support it. We'll continue talking about the data, and neither would Dr. Rossetti. They tried to basically get us to refute our data, deny our data, throw away or destroy our original data showing the infected families and populations, and we refused. And when we refused, we were fired. I told them, no, we won't perpetrate this crime on another generation. We've already done it for 25 years. We've already denied the viruses associated with these diseases for a generation, and I won't do it again. And so when I said that, they carried out their threat. They fired me, they jailed me, they held me in jail without ever having a hearing. They engineered the studies. At one time, Ian Lipkin was on the phone with Frank Rossetti and my husband and the people holding me in jail, basically ransoming my freedom for studies in his, for samples in his study. If I step foot on the NCI property in the labs I grew up in to carry out the experiments to show whether or not this virus is actually, or these viruses are actually a problem in these diseases, I will be taken off campus by security. I will be arrested. And I was arrested within a day or two of that in my home for no reason, without a valid search warrant, with all of my civil rights denied, which have been denied to this day, I've never had a single hearing. You know, I'm essentially a public enemy.
You were convicted without a hearing?
Yeah.
Basically.
Exactly. My freedoms have been removed. I was forced into bankruptcy fraud in a federal bankruptcy court under threat of going back to jail. Where my lawyer sat calmly in the chair, and I said, oh, that's ridiculous, there is no new evidence. And he looked at me and he said, there was no evidence the first time, was there? So you either file bankruptcy, which they take away your economic ability to survive.
Right.
You know, you can't travel to meetings like this. If it weren't for Terry and Ed Aranga and Health Focus, who has sponsored my travel, I wouldn't be here. And then you can't talk. So they have a lot of ways of silencing you. And of course, I'm spending my husband's little retirement that he has in Social Security to go off and talk. So what's going to feed our family? What's going to pay the bills? That's all we've got is my 77-year-old husband's retirement. It's crazy. And for most people, they get away with it. But, you know, they didn't succeed because I was blessed. And a lot of friends came in, a lot of people like Terry and Ann. A lot of people said, we won't let you fall down, Judy. Please don't sign the paper.
Judy Mikovits has amazing conviction and ethics. She wouldn't sign the paper stating that her studies finding retroviruses in vaccines were fraudulent because they were true. This is an incredible case of suppression of data and persecution of a doctor who just wanted to tell the truth. Considering the exponential increase in autoimmune diseases over the past 30 years, is it reasonable to suspect that injecting foreign genetic debris, including retroviruses like Judy Mikovits discovered, wreaks havoc with natural immune functions? Does this have scientific plausibility? I was just reading an article entitled "The Science of Vaccines is Settled." But is science ever truly settled?
In 2003 and 2004, the Institute of Medicine, which is supposed to be the arbiter of medical science in our government, made the declaration that this controversy, the issue about whether thimerosal is causing autism, should no longer be studied, that it was settled now. And you know, no scientist ever says that. Every hypothesis is subject to further adjustments and challenge, and that's what science does. It challenges existing hypotheses and says, is this real? Do the facts that we now know today support that hypothesis, or do we need to rethink it? And they declared no more studies should be done. And then the NIH and CDC and all the institutions got in lockstep with that and said, we're going to defund anybody who wants to look at this question. We're going to make sure that they're not funded. And that's what's happened ever since.
If you've ever taken a science class, the first day in science, what they teach you is science is never settled. That you must always keep questioning. We wouldn't have Einsteins. You'd never have, where's the new ideas come from? You wouldn't have scientific breakthroughs.
Still be flat.
Right, the world would still be flat. The Earth would still be the center of the universe.
Right.
You know, it's the constant question that keeps science advancing. Yeah. And when you hear this statement from almost every politician and every scientist, all the way down to Sanjay Gupta, you know, who we all trust, the science is settled. That's the least scientific statement you could ever make. It's not settled. It can't be settled. That statement is anti-science by definition.
The science is never settled. Because here's the thing. When I grew up, I got one or two vaccines. And as far as I know, they were fairly safe back then, even though they were probably nowhere near safe. But I grew up in a less toxic world. I grew up in Africa. We ate out of our local vegetable garden. There was no pesticides or herbicides. We ate the stuff as it came. We start adding more and more vaccines, for example, but at the same time we're adding pesticides and herbicides and thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of chemicals that are just in our world. And you give that same vaccine today and it might have a different outcome. And then when you keep adding vaccines, you have to start all over with the research because it's never been tested. MMR in the schedule. Now let's add back in 87 the Hib vaccine and in 93 the Prevnar, and then we moved the Hep A down and the Hep B down and we added the rotavirus and then we added the meningococcal and we've added Gardasil now for teenagers and we add. Every time you add, the science is unknown. We haven't even studied it. So we've got to keep our scientific minds open and start looking at what we're actually doing. And unless you look, you don't know. So these parents who have concerns, I applaud you. They're legitimate concerns. And until you can show me the science, you should be skeptical.
Science is never settled. And the more vaccines that they add to the schedule, the more complex it is. I mean, think about just from, you know, adding ingredients when you're baking cookies. You know, the more ingredients you put into your souffle or whatever, it creates a more challenging problem. So the science is never done. And it's disturbing that many people who have spent as much time as I have and others have investigating the problems with vaccines and have come across anywhere from 700 to 1,500 articles that have been published in the mainstream medical journals showing the problems associated with the vaccines, that we're called anti-science when what we're doing is presenting an argument using their science.
This docuseries was created to spur discussion and debate and to provide real scientific studies on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. In order for this to happen, we must always share the truth and be honest. The bottom line is that our children deserve honesty and they deserve truth. They deserve to be protected. They deserve to be safe and healthy.
If kids in America were really healthy, we would know we were doing things right. The proof is in the pudding. If you start looking at the statistics in terms of children's health and you see our children's health is really compromised, so we need to figure out together what is going on. And one of the problems is that we have an overly aggressive vaccine schedule that is not based on the current science. Let's have a conversation, let's have a debate, and let's actually do some real science around these issues so we can figure out which vaccines are safe, which vaccines are necessary, and how do we best protect our kids. I mean, I'll say it again. We all care about the same thing. We care about healthy kids. Nobody wants an infectious disease. Nobody wants to see a recurrence of measles or polio or anything else. That's not what this is about. What this is about is making sure that we're not compromising our children's immune systems as we're trying to protect them against certain infectious diseases. And that is actually what's happening. So what's happening is that we have such an aggressive vaccine schedule, we are doing too many too soon. And because of that, our children's health is suffering.
It's been an interesting ride for the last 20 years, but we did what we should have done, and that is listen to parents who came to me and said, my child was fine, they were developing normally, they got an MMR vaccine, they developed bowel problems, and they regressed into autism. I knew nothing about autism, but I did know a lot about inflammatory bowel disease. So the symptoms in these children clearly merited investigation. We got them together with the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist, Professor John Walker Smith, and his team, and we investigated them, and the parents...
Ending it at 1:21, there's 8 minutes left. It'll come next.